Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And here we are in the new year and a fresh podcast as we take a look at what lies ahead in 2018. So it is our first of the year. I'll say Happy New Year to all the listeners out there. And today we're going to talk. We're going to go back to talking politics. We've been doing a lot of theater as of late. But, you know, so much in the political world happens on a moment by moment basis. And actually, as we are doing this podcast today, there is sort of breaking news that I recognize in the coming days will, you know, have been in the papers and on the Internet for a while. But we want to tackle this as it's happening, as it's unfolding, maybe look ahead to see where it might go. So joining me is Democratic strategist Brad Bannon. He's the president of Bannon Communication Research. Always available when I call on him to give us his insights. Brad, Happy New Year to you, and thank you for your first visit of the year to the podcast.
Paul, it's always a pleasure to be on with you.
So the news that is sort of breaking as we talk is a new book coming out called The Fire and Fury in the White House, something to that effect, by Michael Wolff. And wow, here's a guy who clearly has talked to hundreds of people to get this book ready. A lot of Steve Bannon attributed quotes that Bannon takes credit for. And Bannon has not a lot of good stuff to say about this White House or Jared Kushner or Don Jr. He really goes after everybody. And in a time when the White House says there's no Russia thing going on, it's all nonsense, how much credence will we put in comments by Steve Bannon, who did lose his job, and now he's outside the White House, when he starts saying, oh no, there was definitely stuff going on?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. Steve Bannon, and by the way, I'm not related to the man, thank you.
Always good to clarify that.
Yeah. He obviously has an axe to grind. He got fired from the White House. And so he's using this his presence in this book by Michael Wolff as retaliation. And it's pretty strong stuff. At one point, he called the Trump family traitors. He said the relationship with the Russians was all about laundering Russian money into the Trump campaign. It's pretty compelling stuff. He also takes special aim at the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who he says is the mainspring in all this. And he says Kush is going to crack open like an egg when the special prosecutor gets at him.
Yeah, I think he said Junior's going to do that, right?
Yes, Junior. He also says that Junior, after Junior had a meeting with Russian operatives in Trump Tower, Bannon says Trump Junior brought them up and introduced them to then candidate Trump, which the president said he has actually had no contact with any people.
Right.
Bannon says he did. And in
fairness to the accuracy, you're right that that's what Bannon is saying. It is not. Michael Wolff kind of makes the point. We don't know for sure that that happened. Essentially, actually, Bannon says he doesn't know for sure that it happened. But what he says is he can't imagine it didn't happen, and he's basically 100% sure it must have. But he doesn't know for sure. Well, with all of that being said, and adding all sorts of pieces to this puzzle, but look, the White House, the president already speaking out, the president making a comment along the lines of, you know, not only did Steve Bannon lose his job, but he's lost his mind. Here's the thing. If you are not a Trump fan and you're a Democratic strategist, you're no Trump fan, you know, you would look at this and say, well, things are really going to hit the fan now because, you know, Steve Bannon was an insider. This guy knows. But, you know, within moments, the White House speaks out, calls Steve Bannon names. And do you have any doubt that that third of Trump supporters around the country will simply stand up and say, yeah, this is just Bannon, you know, trying to get retribution. He's just lying.
Well, the problem with that, Paul, is that if you look at Donald Trump's supporters, a lot of them are arch-conservatives who think Steve Bannon walks on water. So that may be a problem for the president. You know, and you're right about the charges about candidate Trump meeting with the Russians. There's no way Bannon has no evidence that actually happened. But when he talks about other things, like the using the Russians to launder money into the Trump campaign, that I think that's what the special prosecutor is looking into. So I think some of the charges Bannon has leveled against President Trump are in fact things that the special prosecutor is seriously looking at. Others are kind of sensational without any evidence, like the possibility of a meeting between candidate Trump and the Russians.
This is crystal ball time, but there, I get this gut feeling. And, of course, what the special prosecutor Robert Mueller is doing, that man's in a vacuum. He's in a bubble. He's paying no attention to any of this stuff. You know, nothing coordinated with anything going on. But do you get a gut sense that with the release, soon-to-be release of this book and these kinds of comments, something, it feels like something's about to burst, and I don't know what.
Well, yeah, I think people are expecting Robert Mueller to release a report. No one's quite sure when. I mean, Mueller is very thorough and systematic. He dots all the I's and crosses all the T's. So at some point, he's going to release a report. And the question I think everybody has about what the special prosecutor finds is whether or not Donald Trump was directly involved in this plot to use the Russians to attack Hillary Clinton, or whether it was just members of the campaign like Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, Donald Jr., and Jared Kushner. And that's, I think, is the big question, whether this is going to lead directly to the president or just going to knock everybody off who surrounds him.
It's also interesting that New York Times op-ed coming out by the Fusion group, who said, you know, that all this talk that the dossier is what led to this, it's a fake dossier and it's all made up, that's what led to all this investigation. And apparently, according to the op-ed there, that had nothing to do with what the investigators are going after.
Well, I think if you look at what Mueller's done already, he's using... He turned over Michael Flynn, and I think Flynn is spilling the beans to the prosecutor, and Flynn was sort of the liaison to the Russians. So I think Mueller has some serious stuff that he's working on. A lot of it probably comes from Michael Flynn. So it'll be interesting to see. And I think there's no question that Mueller is going to issue more indictments, maybe at Jared Kushner, maybe at Donald Trump Jr. And I think the question is whether Mueller mounts a serious frontal attack on the president and names him as a co-conspirator in the Russian collusion.
Yeah, if this were a movie, you would claim that the movie jumped the shark already, right? But the other thing I think that you're right about, mine too, my sense is that it's hard to believe that there isn't some kind of focus on Jared Kushner, specifically probably Don Jr. But that's when things get interesting, because the day Mueller comes out, if Mueller comes out and announces any kind of indictment on those guys, now all heck breaks loose. Now you've got pardon powers coming into play. There's no way the president's going to stand for his family members going through any of this. Forget about what points to him. That's when I think the constitutional crisis that we could be facing begins.
Well, yeah, I think the key question, I think you're right. The president could pardon his son. He could pardon his son-in-law. But if he did use his pardon power to pardon his son and son-in-law's co-conspirators, that would create an uproar on Capitol Hill. And I think at that point, you some of the Republican House members and senators start thinking that they have to jump ship. So I think even his use of the pardon has great dangers for the president. And remember, all this is going on in the background of the midterm elections. Right now, Republicans in Congress are deathly afraid, and I think they have some justification to be afraid, that they're going to lose control of probably the House and maybe the Senate, too. And the reality is, if Mueller goes right at Trump, I think a lot of Republican senators and House members are going to panic and start thinking seriously. Maybe impeachment is the way to go here, because we got to get this guy off the radar before the midterm elections.
It's an interesting position you're taking, because my next question to you, and we're going to shift topics, but my next question is along the lines of, you know, people compare this to Watergate, and one reason among others, you probably shouldn't compare it to Watergate, was because in the days of Watergate, you had Republicans with character and who basically looked at what Nixon was doing, and party was put aside, country was put number one, and said, we can't stand for this as a nation. I'm not judging Republicans or Democrats in this comment. I'm simply saying, as what appears to be factual, Republicans don't seem to be standing for country above party. Party seems to be holding it above country. And so even the folks like, you know, Orrin Hatch and his speech in the White House, the folks who, you know, at a time were to say Donald Trump isn't the right person for the country, et cetera, they are now the first to say this whole thing's a hoax, this investigation is ridiculous. Your spin on it being because they're all worried about next year.
The number one rule here in Washington is saving your own butt. And if Mueller comes up with something incriminating against the president, a lot of Republican senators are going to be and House members are going to be afraid of losing their jobs. And if they're afraid of losing their jobs, they will jettison the president without asking any questions.
Well, Brad, before all this news broke, what we were likely to have talked about, of course, and still need to, is the North Korea situation. Kim Jong-un basically touting that he's got a nuclear button on his desk that's pointed at the White House, not the White House, pointed at the United States, that he's got missiles that cover the entire mainland of the United States. And, of course, President Trump meeting fire with fire last night in his tweet, basically saying, you know what, I've got a button that's bigger than his and mine works. I should ask you who's got the bigger button, but the reality of it is this isn't really about buttons, and what are we headed for with this? It's almost like this is a game, and it would almost be funny, except this is serious stuff.
Well, it reminds me of two kids in the sandbox fighting each other. The only difference in this case is that the two kids who are fighting each other have control over nuclear weapons, which is a big difference, and it's childish. There's no way this back and forth is going to help resolve the situation. And, you know, it's, you know, great to talk tough. You know, I mean, I'm reminded every time I hear this interchange between President Trump and Kim Il-sung, I think to myself of Teddy Roosevelt's famous axiom, speak softly and carry a big stick. It seems to me that Donald Trump is speaking loudly and not carrying much of a stick at all, and I don't think that's going to work.
You know, Trump supporters, again, would look at this and say, well, Barack Obama never stood up to him. We're here because it's not President Trump who's escalating this. It's Kim Jong-un who's escalating this. What do you say to Trump supporters who point to that? I mean, there's a grain of truth in that. There is a sense that you're right, that the president is right in the sandbox playing the same game, not taking the high road.
Well, you're right. I mean, there is a third of the American public who are with Trump hell or high water. But that's fine, except a president with a 35% job rating is leading his party into a biblical disaster in the November elections next year. And if Democrats do can take control of Congress, that will end Donald Trump's power. He won't be able to do much of anything. Yeah, you're right. There's always going to be that 35% who are with him hell or high water. But the other 65% could throw a lot of Republicans out of Congress and give Democrats the control of Congress. And that would be a big deal because now you'd have Democratic committee chairmen who could issue subpoenas to the president.
One domestic question on the agenda. Congress on its way back to Washington in coming day. Senate back. House on its way next week. How hopeful are you? It is an election year. Democrats say they're not going to play. The president's tweeting that Democrats are obstructionists and, you know, that the DACA kids will be thrilled with Republicans. They'll love their president. They'll hate the Democrats. Do they accomplish anything? And because it's an election year, that's the argument that they don't. But on the issues like DACA, it's got to be the argument that they must.
Well, you're right. That's the big issue in the standoff on the budget, is the Democrats insist that the president give legislative relief to the Dreamers. The president insists that he wants the money to build his wall. And that, you know, neither side seems willing to back down. I think if the president feels that his hard stand against the Dreamers is going to endear him to Latino voters. He has a very thin hold on political reality.
So in the end, is there a deal? I'll put you on the spot, and then we'll visit it down the line. Is there a deal?
Well, I think there will be a deal eventually. And it may be along the lines of the Democrats saying, okay, we'll give you some money for your wall, but you have to give full legal relief to the Dreamers. I can see that happening, but I don't know. The new deadline is January 19th, which is not very long from now.
Right.
And my guess is they kick the can further down the road and have another continuing resolution and continue to fight this for a while before there's some kind of resolution.
Which also, by the way, chip funding ends in March. They could kick it to that. And, of course, the Dreamer or DACA deadline the president set in March, although there he has said maybe he'll move the deadline, which sort of removes leverage power from him, but at the same time might be what's necessary so they can continue discussions.
Yeah. Well, the thing that Trump has to be careful of is that the Democrats have a lot of leverage here. The president can't pass his budget in the Senate unless he gets 9 Democratic senators to vote for him. And right now, that's not going to happen, which is why the Democrats feel they have the whip hand. Also, he's probably going to need Democratic support in the House because a lot of the far-right conservative Republicans don't like, they think the budget is too big, the Trump budget is too big, so they're going to vote against it, which means they're going to have to find Democratic House members to vote for the budget, too. And so both Nancy and Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the leader, Democratic leaders in Congress, know this, and they're going to use that leverage to the hilt.
It's going to be interesting to watch, Brad. It's going to be an interesting year. Certainly not a quiet one by any means. Brad Bannon, Democratic strategist and president of Bannon Communications Research. Hey, what's your website, Brad? If people want to just kind of contact you,
my website is www.bannoncr.com. www.bannoncr.com.
All right. As always, my friend, thank you for your insight. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Always a pleasure, Paul.
Thanks. Well, did you know we had a state song? That's it. You probably know the words, by the river, gently flowing Illinois. Yeah, we know that song. And it gives us a nice context, because when I hear music like that, played by an orchestra like that, it makes me think of education, institutions, and all the proud institutions that we have here in Illinois. Well, while I happen to be an alum of the University of Illinois in Urbana, I'll give a plug there, there is a different university that is actually celebrating its 150 years in existence. It's Northeastern Illinois University. A gorgeous new book has just come out called Northeastern Illinois University, the First 150 Years, and its author is Richard C. Lindbergh. Mr. Lindbergh is an award-winning author. He's a journalist. He's actually written 17 books about Chicago history and politics and criminal justice and sports, all sorts of topics. And then because he went to NEIU, he took some time to write the history of that university. Rich, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here. Hello.
So writing all that you have, I mean, you know, politics and Chicago history, I'm just curious, was it because what led you to say, and I want to write a book about the history of the university I went to?
Well, actually, I was approached about doing this book many years ago. It was actually around 2010. One of my academic mentors when I was an undergraduate, Dr. Bernard Brommel, professor emeritus of speech and language at Northeastern, Bernie had read many of my earlier books and said to me, Rich, we need a university history. You're the most published student we have, and you should do it. And I said, well, I will think about it. Academic writing is a little bit beyond what I normally do. I write a lot about Chicago crime and politics and history and sports. And educational writing was kind of going a little bit far afield for me, but Bernie was very insistent. He's a very persuasive man. And I said, well, okay, I'll take a shot at it, but with Northeastern's blessing, of course. And And what followed was a meeting with President Sharon K. Haas, and she said, yes, we do need a university history. There had never been an institutional history of Northeastern or its antecedent schools going back to the founding of the institution back in 1867 right. as the Chicago Normal School.
So, and that's, I want to go back in history because, listen, I mean, right now the university is over on St. Louis Avenue. I've been there, and it's a great school. I mean, it's just larger than I expected it to be the first time I went there. But it's not where the roots of this school are. This school has, as you said, history. It actually goes back, as you write, to September 13th, 1866, when the Cook County Board of Commissioners actually said, hey, here's a proposal. Let's talk about this. Should we establish what at that time was going to be called a county normal school? Now, the word normal, why normal?
Well, it's actually, it borrows upon a French phrase, the École Normale Supérieure, meaning normal superior school, which was established in Paris, France in 1794 as a kind of a training ground and a training school for prospective teachers and educators. The term normal school was adopted in the U.S. Beginning really in the 1830s when Horace Mann became its champion and its proponent, arguing that what we needed was preparatory training to produce good teachers and good educators. In the frontier days of American history, it was very common for people to be selected to be teachers with no real training credentials. Kids were educated through what they used to call rote memorization, that is, recitation of verse that they had memorized. And while they became very good at memorizing Shakespeare and the classics, did they really actually understand it was the other question. So with that said, Horace Mann became the greatest champion of the normal school movement, and it really launched in New England in the 1830s and pushed further west. And in fact, the origins of most of our state universities in the U.S., many of them began as normal schools, teacher training schools.
Yeah, and that is where NEIU got its start. This was a teacher training school, and it wasn't where it is now. It actually started one of the early locations, Englewood, what is now known as Englewood. But I'm not talking about today's Englewood.
Well,
it was the Englewood of the 1860s.
It's actually started in Blue Island for 1 year in 1867. It moved over to Englewood, which at that time was a very distant and remote part of the county. It was a very pastoral setting, located about 8 to 10 miles from downtown Chicago, and it was accessible by the emerging rail lines that were just coming into the fore. And gradually, the city of Chicago caught up with it. Now, there were other areas under consideration for the placement of the normal school. Thornton, Illinois was one area. They thought about moving it all the way up to the northwest side in what was in Norwood Park, Illinois, which is, of course, now part of Chicago. But they settled upon Englewood. There were good inducements made. In 1870, the building that was dedicated as the normal college opened up, and there it would remain for many more decades to come.
And it's so fascinating for me as I read through the history of this, just the names that cropped up. I mean, for example, one of the principal of the normal school back in the 1880s was Francis Parker. And people say, yeah, but isn't there a Francis Parker School? Yeah, he resigned from this board and went and started the Francis Parker School, right? Do I have my history right about that?
Exactly. Francis Wayland Parker was a disciple of the Horace Mann movement, rejecting the old forms of education and experimenting with the teaching of concepts and values and becoming interactive with students. It was actually he began with art classes and encouraging self-expression, and this was considered almost heresy back in those days. And Francis Parker achieved great success in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. He received his appointment to come to the normal school in 1882, following the death of Mr. Wentworth, who was the very first principal. And Parker, his title was principal of the normal school, and he really defined the character and shape of education against tremendous political pressure from City Hall and from various more tradition-based educators who just thought that this was not the way children should be properly educated.
Today, Rich, people can study so many different things at any IU, but as you sort of indicated this earlier, but it began as a teacher's college. Was that the only need at the time? We just needed teacher's colleges?
Well, there was an existing teachers' college in Chicago, in the city's first public high school, which opened up in 1856 on West Monroe Street, west of downtown. It was called the high school, and on the top floor there was one classroom that was dedicated to teaching prospective teachers about the ways and means of teaching and discipline and all the information they needed, but this was proven to be quite inadequate, and it was really for that reason that the first teachers' college got going. It was called the Cook County Normal School, and it was because of the quality of education of those few teachers that were coming out of the city high school was not up to the standards that was set forth by the Illinois Department of Education. We already had one normal school in Bloomington, Illinois, so the Cook County Normal School, when it opened in 1867, really fulfilled the need for Northeast Illinois.
And so over the years it developed, and can you just very briefly kind of give us the history as time, is it just that as Chicago grew, as the area grew, the early 1900s, moving forward, the 50s, the needs grew, and people wanted different kinds of education, and of course the university had to survive, because there were times in its history where, I remember, I think back in the 40s, there was a date where they almost closed the university.
Well, it actually happened several times. In the 1890s, Cook County could no longer pay the bills and support the university, and the transfer was made to Chicago. The Chicago Board of Education assumed management of the normal school, and it became the Chicago Normal School in 1896. During the Depression in the 1930s, there was no money to pay for teachers. Teachers were being paid in scrip in the worst years of the Depression, when Anton Cermak was mayor. The situation was chronic. The school almost closed in 1931, but it persevered and it remained open, and then it filled a tremendous need in the 1950s in the baby boom generation, when thousands and thousands of babies were being born to World War II veterans returning, and the situation was so chronic in the Chicago public schools that they often had eighth graders acting as teachers for kindergartners. There were just not enough teachers to go around, and these were the boom times for the Chicago, by which time it was called Chicago Teachers College. And it was times were so hectic that they opened up branches in various Northside high schools to encourage Northside students to enroll in the teacher training programs. There were satellite campuses at Schurz High School, Wright Junior College, Foreman High School, because exclusively located where it was in Englewood, it was a long commute for Northsiders and Westsiders to actually go there. So this was really the early genesis of Northeast Illinois University, was the expansion into the Northside high schools in the 1950s.
So it had to be fascinating for you to do all this research and learn the history of the place you went to school. Rich, was there anything you learned as you went through this history that surprised you? I'm sure there was a lot you didn't know about the history, but anything you went, wow, that's cool.
Well, I was I guess I never fully comprehended the evolution of our state universities, and to the great extent that state universities were essentially all of them founded as teacher training colleges in the 19th century. And then beginning around the time of World War I, these normal schools, they shed the name normal school and they became colleges, and then they gradually evolved into state-run universities. Northeastern became a university in my freshman year in the fall of 1971. It had had a number of different names, which was called Chicago Teachers College North, Northeastern Illinois State College, and then finally Northeastern Illinois University, which it is today, and it is a growing multicultural center. They built their first dormitories on campus this past year, and increasingly it's becoming more of a center for international study than it ever was before, or what they even imagined 50 years ago.
What do you think the original founders of the school, the original Cook County board members, what would they say if they could see what the university looked like today?
Well, I think they would be astounded. They would be astounded to see how education has changed, the fact that college education has become so universal for so many students, whereas in those days, generally, if you went to college, you came from a fairly affluent family that could afford it. There was very little in terms of state scholarship money available. So you were either born into wealth and privilege with the right to go to college, or you didn't go to college. That has been the great real social change of public education since the time of World War I.
And just so amazing that this university has lived through that history, 150-year history.
Now, and it's something that people don't really know about. They think of Northeastern and say, oh, well, didn't that school open up in the 1960s? But they don't understand this lineage goes all the way back to 1867.
Exactly. Well, they do now, especially if they get a copy of the book, Northeastern Illinois University, The First 150 Years by Richard C. Lindberg. You can get it at the bookstore. The university has a bookstore, which is on campus, or just get it online. I know that's available as well, they tell me. It's a beautiful book. I mean, I realize this is a podcast, so folks can't see it, but it's a beautiful sort of coffee table-looking book. And congratulations on it. Were you part of the you did the history, the writing, were you part of the photography, the photographs entering into it?
Well,
you have a staff.
A lot of the photos are drawn from the archive, the university archive, and Joe Davis, the photographer at Northeastern, was tremendous. The book represented 5 years of intense research and interviewing. There had never been a history of this university written before. So I really had little to work with, and it was 5 years in the making, and I think it's something that's very worthy and representative of the university.
Something to be proud of, as I know the university is. Northeastern Illinois University, congratulations on the first 150 years. Richard Lindberg, thanks for memorializing that, capturing it in the book. I congratulate you on a great project. Good luck with the next project.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.